Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the second week of September. This week, we are very pleased to have Dr. Fred Sharp joining us again, with part two of an interview recorded with him back in mid-July of this year. Part one of this program was about prairies of the Olympic Peninsula, and part two follows on this theme, with Fred focusing on one of his favorite plants found in our native prairies, the common camas. If you would like to listen to the first show on prairies as a companion piece to this one, please go to kptz.org and do a search in the Nature Now podcast for it. And we are especially pleased to have our faithful sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, by our side to help share events and observations with you. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, Deborah.
Before we get to the main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this week's sound is that it is one associated with our prairies. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
We continue to move towards fall, and while we are always sad to lose our migrant breeding birds, most of which are already on their way south for the winter, it always makes us happy to welcome back our winter tribe. Many of these are shorebirds that are returning from their nesting season in Alaska and include western and least sandpipers, greater and lesser yellowlegs, spotted sandpipers, and large flocks of black turnstones, which are often accompanied by surf birds.
With all of the dry weather that we've been experiencing, water sources are a great magnet for all wildlife species. These water sources do not have to be fancy bird baths or water gardens. My neighbor, Jeff Hammerson, has recorded many species using a hollow that they regularly fill with water in the driveway for bathing and drinking. These species include all of the forest bird species, including Wilson's and black-throated gray warblers, both species of chickadees, brown creepers, Swainson's thrush, nuthatches, and hairy woodpeckers, along with an assortment of small mammals, including Townsend's chipmunks, Douglas squirrels, and non-native gray squirrels.
Speaking of Townsend's chipmunks, Jeff also sent us a remarkable photo essay on these chipmunks and their use of bitter cherry fruits. He writes, quote, "Townsend's chipmunks have been removing the pits from the fallen bitter cherry fruits. Sometimes they open the pit and eat the kernel inside, but mostly they are gathering the pits in their cheek pouches and transporting them to their burrows to serve as winter food. They generally discard the fleshy part of the fruit."
This information helped me fill in some of the mystery behind some food caches that I discovered years ago myself. I was finding these weird collections of pits, a handful here, a handful there, in shoes left on the porch, in empty containers left in the basement. And I finally traced them to bitter cherry fruits and figured that the hoarders had to be deer mice. But what I didn't realize is that it's the kernel inside the tough seed that is so prized, and not the fruit. Clearly the fruit is too bitter for even rodents to enjoy, which you will understand if you are ever so foolish as to try one. Just about a week after we recorded this program, we had a very special event take place in our local Kaitai Prairie. As most of you know, Port Townsend was honored by a visit from a number of Native American tribes in our region back in July, as part of what has become an annual ceremonial canoe journey. A few members of the Jamestown Clallam tribe took this opportunity to meet with a few members of our local chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society for a ceremonial camas dig up at the Kaitai Prairie. Hopefully this will be the start of reviving a wonderful old tradition. Now on to the core of the program, for Fred Sharp will share with us the wonders of Camas Quamish. Last month we spoke about prairies on the Olympic Peninsula, but today we'd like to speak specifically about one of the loveliest of indicator plants of our prairies, the common camas. So, Fred, camas is probably your favorite species these days, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's just a divine plant, and you can't fail to notice its beautiful, beautiful purple flowers with oranges, yellowish stamens. Locally, it grows in great profusion here on Kai Tai Prairie. I was first introduced to the camases when I was doing my botanical work up in the San Juan Islands. Just marvelous plant. It's one of the first to bloom. And these purple sheens, you know, when Lewis and Clark, when they came into the country across the western plains, they encountered camas, and they were first beguiled into thinking that they were seeing these large lakes, these
Wow.
clear blue water lakes. And it turned out just to be the camases that flourishes oftentimes in these valley bottoms and wetter areas. And
what must have looked like that, right? We talked last time about our little pocket prairie at Kai Tai, that's corner of the Port Townsend
yes.
golf course.
Yes.
But that whole valley before,
oh,
it must
yeah.
have been just like that. Must have
just
been a blue,
fabulous
a blue sea,
display
right?
of wildflowers.
Flowers.
And those are very likely the species that so mesmerized Archibald Menzies and Captain George Vancouver when they came into these areas. And it's just such a remarkable plant for so many reasons. Like, what's not to love about it? They're becoming more popular now for food security and resurgence of native spirituality and food plants. And they're fantastic because they're so adapted to our local habitat, right? They don't require any watering, and they respond extremely well in the garden and local plots. And they're climate change adapted. And these wildflowers are really important. The whole community of these plants, these prairie plants, you know, they support natural pollinator communities of bumblebees and mason bees and butterflies and hoverflies and, of course, the European honeybee. We're finding that with the hives that are collapsing, suddenly there's a huge emphasis now on our native pollinator communities that have been here forever and can help pick up the load of pollinating our local food crops. The bulb of the camas was a very important food plant by the native peoples.
And that would have included the Tlalum and
yes,
who else?
Yes, the Tlalum, the Salish peoples, the Quileutes, Macaws, Quinaults, they all have camas prairies on their ancestral lands. And of course, down along the Skokomish and the former Chimicum Prairie was probably a fantastic camas beds. And these plants, they're important. They apparently can buffer against diabetes in the form of the carbohydrates that are provided by the plant. They're delicious. They're actually used as a sweetener. Very, very important, highly prized. In fact, they're one of the most heavily traded food items of the Tlalum outside of the choicest cuts of salmon. So they were extremely important food plant. And that's been a big part of our prairie restoration efforts, is finding out, you know, where the camas occurred formerly, going back to these prairie sites that the Prairie Prowler Group, headed up by Stan Graham and Dave Peters, have been a key indicator plant and a key food plant. Any place you find this plant, you very likely have an ancient ancestral prairie. The Tlalum have been very interested in replanting this plant and getting it back a part of their culture again, so it's extremely exciting.
But there's also a poisonous lily species, the death camas. You can't just go cavalierly collecting
right.
bulbs. You have to make sure.
It's a very beautiful plant. It's the death camas. And it's very distinctive. It's, instead of a purple blossoms, it has a spike of creamy yellowish to white blossoms. It also has the grass-like leaves. But the challenge is that the bulbs, when they're in the soil during the non-blooming season, they're virtually impossible to distinguish in the field. So you have to be extremely careful not to get the death camas in with your native camas. The smart thing to do and the ethical thing to do is just to obtain seed of the purple camas, which you can obtain through Forrest Schomer at Inside Passion Seeds, and then plant those in your garden, and in a couple of years you'll have this fantastic crop of the edible purple camas.
Have you tasted the bulbs?
I have had the good fortune a couple times to taste the bulbs that were dried. They're delish.
The process is that you dry them and then roast them, or do you roast them fresh? Or
there's a number of ways that they could be prepared. The native peoples, you know, they actually sort of had like a permaculture with these plots that they were owned by individual families, just sort of like a stretch of the river was, and they were
and
inherited.
They were really highly regarded, right? They were staked out, and that was like the family plot.
Absolutely,
of
yeah, yeah. They were inherited and owned. You had certain rights to them, which you would share with other family members, or you would trade use to them for other products. Clallam were great exporters of camas, and their camas would get shipped out to the coast to the macaw in trading for whale oil and dentalium shells, which was a type of money, a little spiral shell that they would get out there in deeper water habitats. The harvesting of camas was, it was really cool. It was a prerogative of elderly women in the tribe.
They had special digging tools,
That's right. They had an amazing digging sticks that were primarily made from ocean spray. Ocean spray is also called ironwood, and it grows
in these long... Which anyone would know if they've tried clipping it, which I have. It occasionally takes over in my woods, and I've tried kind of clipping it, and it's hard.
It produces very sturdy, stout stems, and these can be modified into these digging sticks. We're about 3 feet long or 4 feet long, and depending on the size of the individual, and they would take these ocean spray or ironwood staves, and they would harden the tips in the fire. Then they would use sort of like a T-bar handle made out of antler bone that would go over the top, so you would have this amazing digging stick tool that you would use to push down into the soil and sort of rotate the curved shaft of the digging stick, and they could pull up blocks of soil, and they would pick out the camas bulbs.
Basically thin them. They would do it carefully so that they would retain the health of their plot.
Exactly. It would actually increase the abundance of camas, just like many species of plants, by keeping them thinned out and maintained. They would often take the medium-sized to larger bulbs, and then they would replant the smaller bulbs back into the soil, and they would grow up. And it was hugely important for increasing soil fertility and through aeration and through the digging. And so it was a highly sort of sustainable form of permaculture. They would also, weed the plot, particularly for the death camas, get rid of those bulbs. Then they would replace the soil blocks, and it was a huge and important part of these native prairies, their maintenance and keeping these sites open. And once they had the bulbs, they would then be cooked in these large ground ovens, these earth ovens or pit ovens, and they would dig an area out.
And aren't there some old photos in this area of like heaps of, thousands
of
camas bulbs that were being prepared?
Yeah, it was a big production.
Uh-huh.
About this time of year, they would gather, or when they were flowering, and so they could usually identify the camas bulbs, the edible camas bulbs. And it was huge. Different family groups and tribes would all travel together, and they would have these big digging events and roasting events and ceremonial and potlatching based on the camas. And these ovens would be up like sometimes 4 or 5 feet across and several feet deep, and they would line them with large rocks and build fires over the top and would heat these rocks up very hot. Then they would lay down a bed of vegetation, large leaves, maple leaves or skunk cabbage leaves, and then they would put the camas bulbs on top of this and put another layer of vegetation and more hot rocks, and then they would cover it in earth. So you have these big, hot, steaming rocks that they could pour water into from a hole in the top of this mound of this oven, and that would essentially, they would steam the bulbs for up to 3 days.
Wow.
And that would convert these starchy bulbs into these delicious taffy-like sugars, highly prized item once they would dig those back up, or they would also dry them. The bulbs would get kind of dark, but they were apparently delicious. You hear things that they would taste like candied walnuts or sweet yams with a touch of chocolate.
And wow.
Beautiful.
So is that tradition continued at all?
There are definitely some tribes where there's just been this unbroken chain of peoples harvesting these bulbs and sharing the knowledge with their children and grandchildren. The Grand Ronde tribe and Nez Perce and the Clallam are very interested in returning the camas sort of food systems back, alternative to European foods that we utilize so heavily now. So there's some great efforts there to bring back the camas prairie. In fact, if you go through the Clallam campus at Jamestown, there's some beautiful rain gardens with wonderful camas plants growing there now in these rock gardens. That it's just amazing, because once you bring them out of the wild where the soils are often drier and there's competition with other plants, and you get them into the garden and they are just magnificent the way these plants grow. In fact, the camas has been maintained in the Western European American consciousness through seed catalogs. because they're such handsome, gorgeous plants. In fact, you can go online and find the seed. It's often marketed as the American hyacinth.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is. Do they mention in the plant description that the bulbs are edible?
Typically, they don't. Yeah, that's sort of this hidden, amazing beauty of this plant, that it's really one of these remarkably important food plants. And so there's lots of reasons to have it in your garden. As we discussed, you know, they're climate change adapted. They don't really require much watering. They're incredibly beautiful and delicious and nutritious.
So where are the best places to see it on the Olympic Peninsula? It is in dry prairies, and as we described last month, there are also wet, boggy prairie areas.
That's right.
It's
amazing,
right?
Yeah.
But we don't get it up in high elevation.
It's exclusively a lowland plant, the camas. You find it, well, here at Kaitai Prairie, and there's records of it occurring formerly out at Protection Island, and it probably occurred all over the Squim Prairies, and that's been a big push to try to find and relocate the camas that was local to each one of these prairies.
In Dave Peters and Stan Graham's efforts of delineating the edges of prairies, or like at the edges of old graveyards, you've been looking for camas remnants to delineate a prairie boundary.
That's right. If you find camas or woolly sunflower or old man's whiskers or chocolate lilies, these are all really good indicators that these sites were formerly in open prairie environments. Unfortunately, despite extensive searches and to the innumerable small prairies that made up Squim Prairie, millions of bulbs that probably flourished there with the Clallam peoples, they've all seemed to have disappeared.
Kind of like the buffalo. This seems like you'd find little remnant patches, wouldn't you?
You would think the last known population disappeared. Bill Wood had a sighting in about 15 years ago, and it was over by the new big box Walmart complex.
Oh,
so, I know. But the cool thing is that there's still these fantastic high-quality remnant prairies in our area here that can act as...
That are really prolific
now.
Yeah,
prolific.
I mean, like at our little pocket prairie, there the seeds pods were just...
Yeah, they're
rattling.
Locally
they were
abundant.
Full.
So these prairies, they're returning. There's a great interest in farmers now, and all the exciting new agricultural activities that are happening here around Port Townsend and the Quimper Peninsula and on the Squim Prairie. Lots of people are really excited about growing these camas bulbs and bringing it back into the fold. So it's a really exciting time.
Including the tribes.
Yes, absolutely. The tribes, absolutely. And yeah, it's just so great to have this plant rediscovered for all kinds of reasons. It's an exciting time to be in botanical sciences.
Yeah. So specifically, how would people get involved?
Well, there's our local Native Plant Society. It'd be fantastic. You can contact them easily online. Also, if you go on the Forest Service website to get in touch with Dave Peters and Stan Graham, they'd become prairie prowlers and help them look for these indicator plants. Also, this new group that's been started up by Forrest Schomer and myself.
Which you've been part of.
Yeah, it's been really exciting.
And Howard also.
Howard Sprouse, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's called Olympic Peninsula Prairies, and you can go on our Facebook page and find out about exciting things that are going on with camas and our prairie plants.
So they can be propagated by seed and also by bulb division?
Yes. The bulbs, that's the fastest way to get blooming plants, but really the more rewarding and deeper way is to acquire the seed and grow that yourself. It's a great way to bring back these ancient, locally adapted bioregional food systems.
With the seed, do you think that there will be some results by next year? Will people have started trying to
It usually takes a couple of years, you know, 2 or 3 years. The plants can probably live to be 20 or 30. In fact, we don't even really know what the upper limit of their age is. It usually takes a couple of years. The first year, they have these beautiful little tear-shaped bulbs about the size of a water drop. They're just delightful. About the fourth year, they're about the size of a golf ball and ready for harvest with their beautiful blossoms.
I don't get very good sun at my place, or I would try to get some going. Plenty of other people do have the ideal locations for them. So hopefully we'll find lots of little camaslings. Camas seedlings cropping up all over.
Absolutely, yeah. They make such a beautiful addition to your garden. It's exciting. Get out there in your gardens and get some seed started, and in a few years you'll be richly rewarded.
Yes, indeed. We'll have a big roast.
That sounds great.
The Port Townsend Camas,
yes,
Camas
sounds,
roast.
I'm in.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We will look forward to talking with you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks.
Now, back to this coming week. There are a couple of fine upcoming natural history events to tell you about. It's finally time to join the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for International Coastal Cleanup Day this Saturday, September 15th. Hopefully you are all able to listen to Nan's very interesting talk with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's director, Janine Boir, a couple of weeks ago about the huge problem of plastics in our oceans, and were inspired to go help clean up our beaches. Go to ptmsc.org for more information and to pre-register for the event.
Then on Wednesday, September 19th, join the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society chapter up in Squim for the general meeting and potluck at the Dungeness River Audubon Center. The potluck starts at 6 p.m., with the meeting following at 7. The evening program will feature pelicans, herons, egrets, and more. Go to OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for more details.
And here's our mystery sound again. Isn't this a lovely sound? It's a western meadowlark, a species closely associated with prairies and other open habitats, and it was one of the first sounds that I fell in love with as a child. I spent quite a bit of time in Colorado growing up, and I would hear this beautiful sound all over the open grasslands when I went riding. These birds are also beautiful to behold and very distinctive. They're large birds, about 9.5 inches long, with bright yellow fronts with a dramatic black chevron across their chests, and a strong bill. They belong to the blackbird family, and I learned a very interesting thing about them and the rest of their blackbird kin on the great program BirdNote. One of BirdNote's science advisors, Dr. Gordon Oriens, was invited on to discuss an unusual adaptation in blackbirds, a family of birds on which he is a world-renowned expert. Quote, "Blackbirds have an unusual method of foraging, which is called gaping. And what gaping is the ability to forcibly open the bill against some pressure, so that a bird like a meadowlark can push its bill into the base of a grass clump, forcibly open it, and that reveals the insects that may be hidden down in the base. Now, what's unusual about this is that most birds have their most powerful muscles for closing the bill, because they have to snap or grab or crush seeds or insects. The blackbirds that are powerful gapers have stronger muscles for opening the bill than they do for closing it, so that they can generate quite a bit of pressure to open the bill. The shape of the head in these blackbirds is such that they can focus their eyes forward and see right down to where the tip of the bill is, so anything that's exposed, they can look straight at it. Although they're not blackbirds, starlings also gape as they work over a lawn. If you want to learn more about this and all sorts of other cool things about local birds, go to their website at birdnote.org. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the second week of September. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie. This one last time, a bittersweet moment for me. As most of you who are regular listeners to the program will know, after 6 years of invaluable service, Charlie has decided to take a break from this crazy volunteer job as sound engineer and editor, and so much more for Nature Now. We cannot thank you enough for all your help, Charlie, and hope that we managed to survive without you. And we privately hope that you agree to come back for the occasional guest appearance. So thank you so much, and thanks to all the rest of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Billy the Kid, Sweet, Introduction, The Open Prairie, Aaron Copland, and the London Symphony Orchestra.